Welcome to I'm Feeling Queer Today. This season, we're taking a queer road trip all around the country.
Spartanburg, South Carolina.
Cape Cod.
Provo, Utah.
Columbus, Ohio.
Philadelphia.
To answer the big question, what is it like to be queer where you live?
Utah is known as like the Mormon state,
but we actually have a really big community, and for the most part, it's really loving.
If I want to be a queer Mormon, I can be a queer Mormon.
I always say I love Columbus, I don't like Ohio.
I'm trans, so like I hope they can see Spartanburg. You can be a reasonably happy queer adult.
Provincetown taught me to be more adventurous. I get free drag shows every day, just have to look out my window.
You know what place is really cool? Philly. I mean, we have a gayborhood for a reason, you guys.
I'm Feeling Queer Today. New episodes drop every Thursday.
Y'all, if you are a queer parent, and I have a feeling you might be, and you're dreaming of the ultimate family getaway, you have to check this out, y'all. Gays with Kids is hosting their fifth annual LGBTQIA+ Family Spring Break from April 2nd through April 6th, 2026. Mark that on your calendars. It is going to be the perfect mix of fun, community, and a beautiful chance to build real connections with other LGBTQIA families, like mine, because we're going to be there. We're going to be there, too, and I want to see you there. This is it going to be 3 nights aboard Royal Caribbean International, cruising through the Bahamas, surrounded by other amazing queer families. If this sounds like your kind of trip, because it does for me, you're going to head to the link in the show notes to grab your spot. Oh, and don't forget to mention that you heard about it from the Queer Family Podcast. And come say hi to me when you're there. Okay, I hope to see you there. Let's get on with this show.
This episode is brought to you by our friends at California Cryobank. Use code QueerFam25 for a free level 2 subscription to their donor catalog and start that family building journey today. It's also brought to you by Be Parent Surrogacy. And if you mention the Queer Family Podcast when you reach out, you're going to receive $2,000 off any service you book. All right, let's get into the episode.
The Queer Family Podcast. Love is love is love on the queer. Love is love.
Especially folks who have to like put a lot of work into becoming parents. It's not just accidental. Like, yeah, queer people are some solid parents overall. Also, like people who have had to look at the world. A lot of us have been told in different ways throughout our life that like, oh, you're not the right thing, right? Your sexuality is wrong. Your gender is wrong. You're doing something wrong. And we had to figure out like, actually, I'm not. Actually, I'm just myself and everything's fine. And so I think like, in particular, queer people are very attuned to like questioning all the narratives to say like, I'm not just going to parent the way I've been told by my culture or by default. I'm going to put this through the filter of like, does this make sense? Is this actually loving? Or am I just going to regurgitate what I've been spoon-fed?
Welcome, y'all, to the Queer Family Podcast, the show all about family, but with gay. I am Jamie, I'm your gay host, and this is the show that celebrates, highlights, uplifts, and normalizes LGBTQIA+ families in all of our fabulous identities. And today's episode is really awesome. I got to sit down with Ash. And now, I want to say, before we jump into today's conversation with Ash, I want to give y'all a gentle heads up. And I want to also let you know kind of where I'm at personally. This episode goes in a lot of really beautiful directions. We talk queer and trans birth work, which is amazing. We talk safety in hospital systems, which is important to talk about. We talk parenting as a queer family. And toward the end, Ash and I step into a topic that feels really tender, to be honest, and also really scary for me to talk about publicly. Palestine, Zionism, and what's happening in Gaza. I don't know if you've noticed, but I haven't really spoken much to it on the show. So if you've been listening to this show for a while, you know that I lead with curiosity and compassion. And I want to be transparent. I am actively learning right now. I'm reading, I'm listening, I'm asking questions. I live in New York City where emotions around this topic run very high. And I have Jewish family and friends whom I love deeply. I never want to contribute to harm or erase anyone's trauma or disrespect people who are genuinely afraid in these times we find ourselves in. And at the same time, I cannot ignore The very real suffering of Palestinian people. I can't ignore the language of apartheid and genocide being used by human rights organizations. I cannot ignore what I am seeing with my own eyes. I cannot unsee what I have seen. So I am learning, I am unlearning, and I am trying imperfectly, very imperfectly, to hold space for complexity without losing sight of humanity. So when Ash and I talk about Palestine, I am not coming in as an expert. Far from that. I'm never an expert. We know that. I'm coming in as a student. I'm coming in as someone trying to understand the lived experience of a Palestinian guest who trusted me with their words. I want to be clear. The goal isn't to debate or to take away from anyone's pain or to tell Jewish listeners what to believe. The goal is to listen. The goal is to witness. And the goal is to keep expanding our capacity for empathy. I know this topic is charged. I know it may feel uncomfortable. It feels uncomfortable for me. But this show has always been about intentionality, compassion, and the courage to hear stories different from our own. And that's exactly what I'm doing here. So with that said, this conversation with Ash is powerful, moving, and layered. We go deep into queer and trans birthing, discrimination in medical systems, and what it means to create liberation-focused care. And we also go into Palestine, gently, honestly, and with so much love. All right, whew. Let's breathe together. Let's keep our hearts open. And please know I love you all, and I am so glad you all show up and listen to this here show. And I know you all care about intentionality and compassion just as much as I do. So Helen, Beulah, they're even here with candles in their hands, ready to go. Helen and Beulah, my fake assistants, can you please roll that beautiful tape? Let's go. Let's get into it. It's so good.
Queer Family Podcast, love is love.
Hey, Ash.
Hey, how's it going?
It is going well. How are you today on this lovely fine day?
I'm doing fine. It's been, the weather's going up and down in such a way where I'm like turning the heat and the AC on back and forth. And I just kind of feel it in my body. Just like, what is the temp? Same.
This fall is killing me. Where are you?
I'm in Southeast Ohio, like along the Appalachian Mountains, right on the foothills there. It's beautiful here.
Yeah. And then I'm sure you're seeing all the beautiful colors.
It's barely turning, but weirdly, a tree like in my yard was struck by lightning a couple weeks ago. So it's like the only tree that is turning colors now. Everything else is still pretty green, but this one tree is just like fried. It's wild.
Well, I'm in New York City and it's gotten like all of a sudden it's like 40 degrees and windy. I'm not prepared. Not prepared. I think we need to get into the pressure cooker moment. I've never called it that. Of your 30-second elevator pitch of who you are and why you're here talking to the Queer Fam Squad. Are you ready for this?
Oh, sure.
On your mark, get set, 30 seconds, go.
I'm Ash. I am a midwife, and I'm also Palestinian. I'm very queer, trans, non-binary, whatever. Those are my long list of identities. It's not even all of them, of course, but I think growing up as a Palestinian person mostly has meant that I've been like very liberation focused my whole life and always trying to figure out like what's at the root of all of this, what's at the root of suffering, what's causing a lot of pain, and that led me right into birth work and teaching, education. I'm also a nurse, so that's my 30 seconds.
Boom. Oh my God, Ash, that's beautiful. And I love how you wove suffering and birth together, because I've made the correlation between birth and suffering, but you putting it on the backdrop of Palestine and the need for freedom. Oof, that was deep. That was like very full circle. Thank you, Ash. I love that. You're like an artist too. I can see it.
Just trying to open some doors for you on this chit chat podcast, you know?
I appreciate you. I see you. So Ash, let's get into this. So just to throw it out there for all the listeners. So Ash, you are not a parent at this point in time, or are you a parent?
I am. Yes, I am.
You are a parent.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Oh, wait.
I've got a little 11-year-old kiddo.
I have an 11-year-old too.
Oh, do you?
Oh, yeah. Lord, I hear you. I hear you.
It's an age.
It's an age. It really is. But I'll tell you what, my 7-year-old is driving me crazier than my 11-year-old is right now.
I can imagine.
Is interesting. It's so strange. But wait, I have to hear like a quick elevator pitch of your family building journey, because, you know, in the queer way, it's never straightforward.
So I had a baby sort of like the most simple old fashioned style.
One of the few.
Yes. And I have two incredible co-parents. The person I had a baby with is, you know, no longer a partner, but we're still co-parents. And then my partner now is very much also a parent. But yeah, I birthed our kiddo 11 years ago. We only have one child. Had him at home. And
oh, wow.
For me, unlike most of the people that I work with, the fertility piece of it wasn't like a major part of that. It wasn't like a major struggle. But I would say like being pregnant and going through birth and becoming a parent as a trans person, you know, has been like intimately hard or confusing over mm-hmm. the years. I mean, a lot of people I work with, conception is not so easy, of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, when you're missing, when you have too much of one thing and not enough of the other, or yeah. any of the other. Yeah, it's a little complicated. That's why I have this entire show all about it. But like, yeah. So when you, I like to call it baby dancing, because we don't get to baby dance that much in the queer community. Like we do it a lot, but it doesn't produce a baby. Uh-huh. So I like to call it baby dancing. Were you living a queer life when the conception happened and all that? Like, what's the story there? I'd love to get nosy.
I've always been trans, right? But like didn't know it or wasn't out.
Right. Yes.
And so at that time, I would say I still didn't really understand that like my gender was a big part of like not being a woman was like actually a really big part of the like experience I was having in life. I was definitely queer, but I grew up very self-imposed Christian, like incredibly Christian. So it was something that like I spent a lot of years just like repressing pretty immensely. Mm-hmm. That being said, the person that I had a child with, I loved very much. Like all of that was very genuine. Mm-hmm. But sure, like parts of myself, I think I was probably like still repressing so much. I mean, I think of myself as a person who's probably pan. Like I can, you know, connect with all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. So I don't really view that relationship as being like fully outside of my sexuality per se.
Right.
But like if I had to like Kinsey scale myself, it's probably a lot more on like homo side than not. So yeah.
Same. I tell you what, when I was coming out and like really discovering myself, we didn't have all the alphabet we have now. We didn't have mm-hmm. knowledge of pansexuality and all the things. And I think that if I were to come out in more modern times, I might kind of speak to my sexuality and identity more the way you just did in a way. But, you know, I came out and it was either you were gay or lesbian and bi was a joke back then,
right,
you know.
Right.
And so it was like I went hardcore. OK, I'm a lesbian. Now I just own it and I love it. You know, I love that identity. But interesting how we have really actually morphed in good ways, and we still have a long ways to go to get to true acceptance totally. And all the things. So you had a kiddo and then your partner and you, it just didn't work out. You split up.
Yeah. As far as like being romantically connected anymore and, you know, life partners, but we're still very much family and co-parent together. We live in two homes, but yeah, I'm really proud of the like family we've created together among the four of us.
It's awesome.
And my kid needs three parents. So he's very lucky and also like needed it. He needed some extra.
What do you mean by that? Like, I'm curious because I wonder if my kid needs three because they drive me crazy.
Could be. I mean, I don't mean to make it sound like anything different than it really is. Besides, I just think we all three bring like really different and unique and beautiful things to him that like, you know, when I imagine like any one of us like not really being there, I think there would be a huge piece of like what he needs out of parenting gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Missing. So. And also not all parenting is created equal, right? We're not all doing the same thing as each other, even if it's like the same number of kids or something like that. It's very different. Yeah. So we sometimes joke that we're on advanced hard mode and it's like somebody handed us the controller of a video game and you've never touched a video game in your entire life. And they're like, advanced hard mode. Advanced hard mode, life or death situation, go.
That's parenting.
Okay.
That's literally parent. That's a beautiful way to describe it. We are in advanced hard mode here and there is no take backs.
Yeah.
And you don't get another life. Like, let's go. Figure it out. Oof. That's deep. Parenting is hard. Parenting is hard. And this comes up on my show quite a lot because a lot of times, you know, we incorporate chosen family and we have bigger families a lot of times, the donors involved. And there are multiple parents more than just two in many of our families. And I always say, who wouldn't want more for their children?
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want more when people are like, oh my God, they might have donor siblings. You know, I don't want them to have 100 of them, but like... I don't see how that's bad for them to have more people who love them. As long as we do it in a good, intentional way and we're open and honest about all of the things, I think our children are extremely well-rounded by the way they're raised in these very intentional ways by us queer folks.
Yeah.
That's why I always say we're the most intentional parents out there.
Oh, absolutely. That's, yep. It's totally true. I mean, especially folks who have to like put a lot of work into becoming parents. It's not just accidental. Like, yeah, queer people are some solid parents overall. Also, like people who have had to look at the world. A lot of us have been told in different ways throughout our life that like, oh, you're not the right thing, right? Your sexuality is wrong. Your gender is wrong. You're doing something wrong. And we had to figure out like, actually, I'm not. Actually, I'm just myself and everything's fine. And so I think like, in particular, queer people are very attuned to like questioning all the narratives to say like, I'm not just going to parent the way I've been told by my culture or by default. I'm going to put this through the filter of like, does this make sense? Is this actually loving? Or am I just going to regurgitate what I've been spoon-fed because it didn't work for my gender, didn't work for my sexuality? You know?
Exactly. And then we're parenting with that mindset and our children are getting this like way more compassionate, in many ways, approach to just life, right? And that's why I feel like our children are really in tune with the struggles in the world because we're raising them with that mindset, right? Like,
if
something hurts someone, that's not a good thing. If it's. I know a lot of other people do this too. I just like to say that queer folks are better because why wouldn't I?
It's good to notice the magic.
Yeah. 100%. So what brought you into birth work and what, like, how did we get down the path that we got? Because you did it the natural way. And then, of course, I know you show up as how you show up. And of course, everything you just said. But what brought you into birth work and what brought you into queer birth work?
I mean, it's funny, actually, I was in nursing school and the first birth I ever saw was, I was like super reluctant. Me and my girlfriend at the time, we were both like in the same class and we were both groaning about having to watch someone birth. We were just like, we're gay. This is gross. And please no. Why do we have to do this?
Wait, had you already given birth at this point or you hadn't given birth yet?
No, we were like in college and I don't know, probably like 19 or 20 or something. And then this baby was born right in front of me. I think we were both crying. I for sure was immediately just like tearing. I'll never forget that birth. I remember thinking, that's the most real thing I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. Like, even though there was like all of this like equipment and hospital and like clinical instruments and all this like stuff around it, I just like could zoom in and I just saw like the baby and the birther, and that was it. And it was incredible.
Interesting. When I saw the only birth I've ever seen up close and personal was my wife, when my wife gave birth to our daughter. I had to go home and like cry for an hour because I had such a like a gut reaction to it. But I didn't have like, it also grossed me out.
Yeah.
Even though like there was so much blood, I wasn't, you know what I mean? But it was so visceral. And then like seeing that magic, it's really magic, is beautiful.
Yeah. And also like for those of us living in the West, you know, I don't think we have like that much intimacy with like life and death like that, right? Like most of us don't actually like kill our own meat if we eat meat, or like maybe some of us garden, but like that's as close as we get to like routine death is like maybe pulling a plant or something.
Right.
And then birth, you know, I don't know. It's just like those are those raw moments of life are pretty foreign to a lot of us in like colonized spaces. So I think I just like felt the starkness of that. And I was like, whoa, there's something here. And I just kind of followed that thread. I was already exploring like, what is suffering? Like I was mentioning before, what is suffering? Why is everyone hurting so much? Why is there violence? What is the root of violence? Why are there people occupying my ancestral land? And like, why? What is this about? And for, you know, like, why was my dad shoved out of the home of like his great, 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 great grandparents for no reason? Just like, where is violence coming from? And in following that thread, I was thinking a lot about separation and the way that we're really separated from each other as people, separated from the land, separated from a lot of us are separated from our ancestry, whether it's people like who are colonizers, right? Who like left their home of origin to go settle and colonize somewhere, or if it's people who have been abducted from their home of origin to be enslaved somewhere else, or if it's people who have been colonized on the land that is their ancestral land, but they're being like separated from their own sovereignty and dignity, just like so much separation from self, from land, from people. And that just kind of kept taking me back to birth and like what modern birth looks like in a modern context. And I mean, it's there's a birth crisis happening, you know, like just clinically speaking, medically speaking, in colonial healthcare, like there's a lot of problems happening.
Can you speak to that a little bit? I want to hear
more. I think it's like specifically since like 1987, we've had like pretty rapidly increasing rates of mortality for birthers. And we're kind of told that like modern birth in this modern context is safer than ever, or, you know, like definitely being in the hospitals where you're going to have access to like everything safe and you're going to be kept safe and all of this stuff. But the real story is that things happening in modern birth, particularly in hospitals, but also outside of hospitals, so many things happening on labor and delivery units, for example, are about money, are actually about saving costs and not about evidence. So there's so many things that are actual like routine policy in birth practice that are completely contrary to what the evidence shows is actually safest. And then when you really get down to why, a lot of it tends to come down to money. Like, you know, it's cost saving.
That's American healthcare for you, in a nutshell, right? We'll be right back.
Queer Family Podcast, love is love.
Okay, folks, you know how on this show, we talk a lot about the search for the superhuman, that wild little roller coaster we all go on when we're scrolling donor profiles at 2 a.m. trying to convince ourselves we're not losing it. Yeah, that one. Well, California Cryobank is where that journey gets a lot easier, y'all. California Cryobank has been helping LGBTQIA+ families for over 45 years. And their donor catalog is massive. Like, you will start creating spreadsheets massive, which is a good thing. And they offer detailed medical histories. They offer baby photos, adult photos with some donors. They offer personality tests, staff impressions. You get the picture. It's basically queer family Pokemon. And I am in Pokemon mode because my 7-year-old is obsessed. We gotta catch the right one. And because they actually care about LGBTQIA families, they give you things like genetic counselors, family planning support, donor matching tools that don't make your brain melt, letters for second parent adoption, you get the drift. So if you're in the donor search chapter of your family building saga, head to California Cryobank and use code QueerFam25, and you're going to get a free level 2 subscription to their donor catalog. You can also use that code on a discount to their level 3 subscription, which gives you even more things. Go find your superhuman. Go make the babies and then come tell me about them. Yes.
Hey, it's Hillary Frank from The Longest Shortest Time, an award-winning podcast about parenthood and reproductive health. We talk about things like sex ed, birth control, pregnancy, bodily autonomy, and of course, kids of all ages. But you don't have to be a parent to listen. If you like surprising, funny, poignant stories about human relationships and, you know, periods, The Longest Shortest Time is for you. Find us in any podcast app or at longestshortesttime.com.
Love is love.
My wife and I we both did hospital births. And also, you know, just to throw this out there, like I was afraid of a home birth because I was afraid something wrong was going to happen. And I hear what you're saying. And we made the choice to do it in the hospital. I feel like
whatever you feel you have to do for your own mental health, I think is good. But it's wonderful to hear all perspectives and really get the full picture of what it is and what we're looking at, right? And that's why it's so great to have people like you who's an expert in what you do. And it's, you know, like, there's so much information out there and there's so much conflicting information out there, and it's so hard to sift through it all, especially when you're a pregnant woman with 9 months to figure it all out. I should have said a pregnant person. A pregnant person with 9 months to figure it all out.
Especially if you don't have like any kind of healthcare background or whatever. How are you trying? You're trying to research, like, am I going to use erythromycin ointment or colostrum for my child's, like, you know, eye prevention? Like, it's just like, there's so many things, and to try to navigate those decisions. And especially like, if you really dig into it, which, you know, I recommend people do, and you realize, oh, okay, there's actually more things motivating my doctor's recommendations than just my well-being. There are other things at play. My well-being is a part of it, but there are other motivators. Some of them are like legal. Some are financial. Mm-hmm. Some are just like purely technical related to their training. Some are like just based on their myths, the traditions and myths that they believe that are not based on evidence, but they mean well. Some of it is based on like, they don't have enough vacation time and they're trying to go hang out with their family this weekend, which is great because they're normal people, right? But it's, the point is like, there's more involved than just like our well-being, even with our doctors or providers that mean the absolute best. There's more going on. But you're right about the hospital, just to speak to the hospital thing, where I always say wherever somebody feels safest is where they should birth. There's not like a correct location. Actually, just from a physiologic sense, wherever somebody feels safest during labor is where they're less likely to have as many complications.
Hmm.
And that just translates to like pure physiology, having like a lot of stress. That stress pathway being like overly active during labor does suppress labor and like slow things down and make things like failure to progress occur, or, you know, also called stalled labor or labor rest. And just like lots of complications can arise from like increased fear. So wherever people are going to feel the most, you know, just at ease is a good place, you know, depending on their risk level and such.
And find the person that feels right for you, right? Yeah, find the help that feels right for you. Like, we loved our doctor, so it made sense. But at the same time, I will say, with that hospital birth and with, you know, a practice of multiple doctors who work together, neither one of us had that particular doctor at our birth.
Yeah.
We had a different doctor, each of us, at the birth. So that's one of the things that you should know when you're going into this. And if you want one particular person, then you need to look at all the different avenues that are open and available to us and listen to folks like you, Ash, and really make a decision based on what's in your heart, right? It's because this is one of the most hardest experiences of your life, get birth. And my birth ended up actually being extremely complicated, and I had to have an emergency C-section, which they pushed to the very, very last minute because they didn't want to give me a C-section. I was like at the point, I almost said, just get him out, please, because I didn't want him to die, right? So,
and you knew it was, you could tell it was like, we don't have time here.
No, it wasn't good. And the panic on all of their faces was freaking me out because, you know, anyway, I'm happy that we were in the setting I was in for what happened, but you just never know. And also, you have things for things like that as well, right? Like, what would happen in a situation like that, in a birth like that? You've probably experienced it when things are just, you need to ramp it up to something else. Like, what would happen in a home birth?
In a home or birth center birth? I mean, most transfers from home and birth center birth are not even emergent. Generally, it's like something like somebody's like, okay, I actually want an epidural. I've been doing this for too long. Or somebody's been laboring a really long time and like things aren't majorly changing. And so it just kind of feels like maybe a shift to, or, you know, or the birther decides like, I'm ready to shift and I want to like use more interventions than are available. And then there's some emergencies that are manageable at home or in a birth center, and some emergencies that require transport. So, you know, like for the vast majority of people, particularly lower risk, particularly low risk birthers, so people that are going into birth that don't have like major risk factors, birthing at home, assuming they don't live incredibly far away from a hospital, is definitely a safe choice. Like, there's time to transfer. And there's a lot of things that can be done en route to transfer to, even in like really big emergencies, there are some, you know, there are sometimes there are some interventions that a midwife might be doing like en route up to the OR, for example, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
But it depends also on like the legislation in a particular state and what those things look like and how forward midwives can be and how much in the background they might need to be and things like that.
Right. And which brings us to the queer community and bringing like laws into play and like hospitals, hospital policies and things like that. So let's take it to just you basically focusing your work on queer birth and like, because what certain bodies aren't treated the same in all hospitals. And so like, what is it that brought you to queer work, birth work? And what are some of the things you see and what are some of the things you do to help with our acceptance and comfort and all the things?
You know, I think a lot of the work I'm doing, like as I'm realizing more and more that I do it, it's especially work that's sort of like mentally, emotionally, somatically preparing people on the pregnancy side of things, or even before pregnancy. Like I have people who are still trying to conceive or considering trying to conceive soon that take my classes. And I also have birth workers taking my classes. In whatever process, part of the process, definitely we're talking about labor and birth and like, how can you show up to labor and birth as a queer person, as a queer family, as a trans person? And how can you deal with like the added potential discrimination or the added potential just stress that exists doing these things in a space that's like assuming you're going to be cis, assuming you're going to be heterosexual. But I think a lot of it is actually like just creating community and normalization around birth on the front end of labor. Because then once people go into labor, even if they're experiencing like discrimination here or there, or like a certain nurse walks in that just assumes that your partner is like your sibling or like, you know, the classic type stuff. I think when folks have had like a really strong foundation throughout pregnancy or throughout their like birth work education, if they're a doula or whatever, of like normalization that like all kinds of people birth, we are all bodies who do this. It doesn't define our gender. Our gender doesn't define what we're doing. You know, just normalizing that like a large diversity of people birth, a large diversity of families birth and have children. I think it's like, it builds a lot of resilience for that moment in labor, which is really important to help people's nervous systems, like I was mentioning before, just like staying in the sensation of like, I'm okay. I'm just doing what my body needs to do, which is birth. And I don't have to be like as intimately or deeply affected by like the subtleties around me. But then we also, you know, I get into like a lot of advocacy stuff. How do you advocate for yourself in these ways? Which is really important for particularly BIPOC birthers and also queer and trans birthers, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And so you're doing all of that work throughout the pregnancy. You're working with them throughout the pregnancy and helping think through.
Yeah. I mean, I like have like 3 to 4 birth classes per year and it's like a 8 session class, right? So it's like over a month time. We usually do it over 4 weeks. But what I'm trying to do is like really like prepare people and offer people community to each other because we stay connected in this like online forum. So like, I want it to be more like spread out through a pregnancy, even if like we're only in like active sessions together for 4 weeks. I want it to be, yeah, like something that's preparing them emotionally, mentally, physically throughout.
I think it's really important. And I've spoken to numerous midwives. I've spoken to doulas who work in the queer community. And every time I speak with y'all, like it makes me think, I think I could have benefited from this, but I didn't. We went the full on medical route just because. Full disclosure, and because I have to stay authentic to myself, my wife and I are like, you're the doctor, you have the degree, you tell us what to do. Like, full disclosure, that's kind of how we do it. Like, that's how we are. But when I speak with you and I hear all the extra support and consideration for who we are that you get with someone who does the things you do, it makes me think, oof, yeah, I really could have used this extra support throughout this.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really important thing to bring up, especially because like when you're in the hospital setting, you're in the trauma, you're going through the birth,
if you don't have anybody advocating for you. And we didn't really face much discrimination in the hospital at all. You know, we didn't get any weird thing. They might have mistaken us for sisters or something at one point, but it's even like little nuanced things. Having somebody to advocate for you, like for instance, when I gave birth, it was our second kid, but it was my first pregnancy. And so to all the nurses, I was a first-time mom. I didn't have a kid at home.
Yeah.
Right? So they treated me, and I was a tired, I had a four-year-old at home. I was a tired mom. I was looking forward to getting a good sleep in the hospital, and like the nurses kind of putting the baby, like helping me out with the baby a little bit. And I had a C-section, so it was, I was in a lot of pain, right? So, but they treated me like this is my first baby. Like they thought I was being like a selfish, I don't know how to explain this. But it's a nuanced thing to the fact that I didn't give birth more than once, so they treated me differently.
Yeah.
Had this been my second pregnancy or my second C-section, I feel I would have been treated differently as a mom. But I was treated as a first-time mom who needs to just do it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I feel like having someone like you advocating for me would have made a huge difference, to be quite honest, and just being there for me and helping me through it and helping me afterwards. There was no help in that hospital afterwards. I was on my own.
Yeah.
And that's really hard.
Definitely. It's so hard. It's like,
yeah,
get a little drum bopped on you and then somebody walks away. I think that what you're describing echoes what I hear so many people say. I mean, I don't want it to sound like I'm just talking about my birth class, because there's a lot of really wonderful birth classes, I've just had so many people say like, oh my God, I did not know what I didn't know. And I'm so happy to like have, you know, so much of this, you know, not every single thing we talk about is like queer and trans related, because we're just people talking about birth and labor, right? It's just a childbirth class. But so like learning about the hormones, like what initiates pregnancy and like, but then when you really like dig into all of that, you can end up having conversations that do talk about like, well, where are you going to feel safe and why does that matter? And supporting folks to like make those decisions. I feel like one of my hardest, the balance I'm like always trying to find, and I like sometimes lose sleep over this, which is fine. I just like stay awake thinking about it, is how do I help people feel more confident about the process, about birth itself, instead of so fearful about birth? Because I think that's at the origin of a lot of what's so unwell in the medical birth system, is it's just like fear, 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 anxiety, anxiety, anxiety.
It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. It's going to be the worst thing ever. Yeah.
It's going to hurt and you might die, basically.
Right. Well,
you
right.
And or your baby.
The baby. Yeah, exactly.
Which is like a real
risk. That's
what
risk, I was afraid of.
You know what I mean? Those are not worries for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if you're only thinking about that, that's at the center of our attention, whether it's like ourselves as birthers, but especially if it's at the center of the attention of like our providers,
mm-hmm.
It does impact the way that they do interventions and how quickly they intervene and how much interventions they provide us. And every intervention carries a risk. So those decisions aren't light. But if they're coming at them from like deep anxiety and fear constantly, rather than a fundamental trust for the physiology of birth, like at baseline, it creates a really different outcome, a different environment. I'm working on like, how do I support people to like become confident in the physiology of birth, that we've been doing it for like 200,000 years or however long you think humans have been around.
Yeah.
Here we are. We're not about to go extinct. It's been working for like many thousands of years. Birth is effective. Okay. It's physiologic. It's mundane, boring, old, also beautiful, sacred, amazing. And then on the other hand of things, it's also, in this modern context, there's a lot to be concerned about. How do we prepare? How do we get ready to like interact with these sorts of interactions? I mean, different than you, most people are being, C-sections are being pushed on them when they're not necessarily needed. So that's like more often the situation. And so how do lay people figure out like, well, am I in the half of C-sections that are like unnecessary? Or is this one of the ones where like it's a life or death situation, in which case I would happily go do a C-section.
Right.
But if I'm in the half that are not necessary and they're just adding risk factors to me of surgery on top of birth, I don't want that, but I'm not a doctor. Right. How do I even know? So I want to prepare people for that, but also instill confidence. And that is like, that's the thing I stay up at night trying to figure out.
I mean, I want you to get sleep, but like, thank you for trying to figure that out, because it's really important. And when it comes to healthcare for people with uteruses, I feel like we should be so much more advanced for those of us with the uteruses, and we're not. They're not, and they don't know, and they never know. I just had to have surgery on my uterus to find out if I had endometriosis. Like, but still, it's like, I don't know if you have it, but we think you do. But let's go in, and you know what I mean. Like, there's got to be a better way to work with uteri.
Mm-hmm.
But they still haven't seemed to figure it out. But they know how to make sure, you know, erectile dysfunction doesn't happen to a single penis. So
right. That reminds me of, I'm sure you know this, or maybe you've talked about it with somebody, but they just discovered the clitoris in 1991.
What?
Yeah. Before that, it was just a little pea-sized nub idea. But in 1991, they discovered the full organ of it. But at this point, we had like deeply in-depth penis anatomy, right?
Of course.
Every angle.
Listen, in seventh grade, I learned the vas deferens. I learned, like, I know the parts of a penis.
Mm-hmm. Gotta know that vas deferens.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't know 1991 is when they fully discovered. Like, what the fuck? I'm sorry. What the fuck?
Yeah,
what the fuck?
Very wild.
What the actual fuck? It is maddening. It makes me so angry when I get on this. And I have issues with my uterus. And they don't. And it's been 8 years of me complaining. No, 9 years of me complaining about my uterus pain. And I finally got a doctor to say, ooh, you know what? Let's send you for an MRI.
Yeah.
That's all I needed to do?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? Like, don't get me started, because
no.
I will go to town. It drives me insane. Like, I need a midwife for uterine pain.
It was just your stress and you weren't deep breathing enough or whatever?
Or it wasn't real pain. Like, come on.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know, some people have really bad cramps.
Yeah, just bad cramps.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. And they last 15 days and this is not normal. Like, what? So don't get me started. But I do think we need more midwives in the world for so many more things. And if I had it to do over again, I would. I would incorporate a midwife and or a doula.
Yeah.
And figure out, you know, and I will advise my daughter too, you know, if that ever comes to happen. God, uterine healthcare. The hell. I cannot believe that fact about the clitoris.
Yeah.
Damn.
It's unreal. It's like, I do like different forms of like sex education, especially for adults. And I just like do a lot of clitoris ed where I'm just like, cool. I know you all know about the penis. Let's just balance it out a little bit. And also about intersex too, right? These are like two poles, but like actually humans are really diverse. And these are not the only two, like it's just, we're a spectrum, you know,
we are a spectrum. These
two poles and like everything in between, and all of them are very different from each other anyways.
I think we could talk for hours on all the things this gender war that's happening right now, and all the infuriating things that are being said, and is maddening. We'll be right back.
Queer Family Podcast, love is love.
All right, folks, if you have been listening for a while, you know that the mission of this here show is to highlight all the ways we create families in the LGBTQIA community. And that is why I am so excited to spotlight Be Parent Surrogacy. Oh, I love them. Be Parent is a full-service surrogacy and IVF agency that's been helping intended parents grow their families since 2017. Their team handles everything under one roof, from embryo creation and medical care to legal guidance and emotional support. So you're not juggling 10 different contracts when you're just trying to become a parent. There are no wait lists, which means when you're ready to start this journey, you don't have to sit in limbo for months waiting for a surrogate or a donor match. And because many of us are navigating this process across borders, Be Parent is designed with international LGBTQIA+ families in mind. They have accredited clinics that follow top European medical standards. They have multilingual coordinators. They have full legal assistance, and they support you all the way through getting your baby home. Learn more at beparentsurrogacy.com. You can schedule a free surrogacy or IVF consultation. Oh, and if you mention the Queer Family Podcast when you contact them, you can get $2,000 off your treatment. Go there, go to Be Parent Surrogacy, check it out, and let's make those babies and then talk about them.
Love is love.
I wanted to ask you about your ties to Palestine and if you have family in Palestine, and I just want to send you love and healing vibes.
Yeah.
Because I can only imagine how, I mean, the past 2 years, obviously, how hard this has been, but, you know, the whole story as well.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And I do have family in Palestine. The family I have there, I don't know incredibly well, but we can loosely keep up a little bit on WhatsApp. And then I also keep up with some other friends that I try to support through like a GoFundMe and stuff. But most of my family has emigrated due to like needing to leave throughout the years. So a lot of my family's in Jordan and Lebanon. I have some family in Dubai. And I think that I have an aunt also in Jerusalem, but I don't have contact with her, but I believe she's still there. And my dad died like 5 years ago now. So he was kind of like the person that could keep up with everybody. Yeah. But I don't have Arabic, so it's also just harder for me to like track with all of my relatives. But yeah, it's been, you know, it's been a hell of a time. There's like some incredible things happening, and it's also like deeply like terrifying kind of constantly. But you know, like when my dad died 5 years ago, he's my Palestinian parent. I think about it almost daily. I just like wish he knew how much people knew about Palestine today. Like the whole world is talking about Palestine. The like active like resistance, it's not just like happening on the ground in Palestine, but like it's happening in this media space like throughout the world.
People are paying attention much more than before.
Yeah. And also like trying to figure it out, like the number of people who are realizing that, oh, this is like deeply atrocious settler colonialism. I thought it was something else. I thought it was this like propaganda I've been told that it was about, yeah, like the safety of a group of people who are marginalized. And I thought that, yeah, was a good thing, but it's actually something else. That's just the cover for a very, very atrocious evil process that's been underway for a while. Like so many people are realizing that and learning that. And yeah, I'm just deeply inspired by the people on the ground in Gaza who do not give up. They have been hoping and fervent day in and day out through deep suffering, through, you know, starvation. And
I can't imagine, and I am one of the people who was very ignorant to the conflict at all, really.
Yeah.
And I have been learning a lot, and I've been trying to understand both sides, because I'm in New York City. So both sides are very adamant in New York City of this argument. And it's been challenging, to say the least, to really figure out what is the truth here and what is actually going on. I'm learning so much, and it is good that people are paying attention. And what can we do? Like, I'm asking you, a Palestinian person, like for those at home, and I'm sorry if this is taxing and you don't have to answer that, but like, what can we do? What can we do? We're watching these atrocities on our TV screens. We're so far removed. What can we do? What can we do?
Yeah.
This violence.
You know, that's a big question that also is like not answerable for every individual in one particular like blanket way. But I think some of the work that you're doing, and probably folks listening are doing, where you're talking about like, okay, I'm hearing this both sides stuff, and like, look into what we call both sidesism. Like, it's basically, that's a thing. That's another like part of propaganda myths that like, even people who are just trying really hard are like, I'm a person who loves people and I care about people. I'm not here to like, you know, whatever. And the way that both sides thinking can actually turn into like enabling oppression. And it's sort of like, if we look at a violent relationship, somebody that we know is violent to someone else who is in that relationship, if we just like really like equally take both sides in a particular way, we're actually just like not holding a predator accountable. we're actually enabling what they're doing by deeply respecting their narrative, which is probably really true and honest. They're like, that person makes me do this stuff because they're crazy or they're whatever.
That person believes their side.
Oh, yes. Deeply.
Right.
So we have to like get a little out of that somewhat and to like look at things slightly more objectively. And I don't mean to say don't listen to people's perspectives, but
no, right.
But like at the very least, yeah, definitely look into perspectives from Palestinian people. You're not going to hear the same stuff. And then like, if you're comparing and contrasting, eventually you're going to find truth. Like, and it's, I will say it's not too hard in the sense that when I say it's not too hard, I don't mean there isn't stuff to study or try to figure out or look into, but the it's complicated thing is also, you know, a very widely perpetuated myth from, from Zionist rhetoric. It's too complicated to understand. And that's why people disengage. They just sort of like go into freeze or fawn mode about it. We're like, I don't know. I'm not there. It's not my thing. I can't.
Which we can't afford to do.
We cannot.
Especially right now. And especially at all. But
yes.
And I appreciate everything you're saying here. And it, like, you look at the numbers, you look at what you're seeing. It comes to is somebody being hurt here? Is somebody, are somebody's rights being taken away? Is somebody being hurt here? And then, like, when I decipher it in that way, I can only come to one conclusion.
It is possible for victims to become predators. And I think that's really hard for people to, like, swallow that pill. And that's not to say, like, all victims have become predators, right? We have, like, some of the most, like, active, persistent accomplices in defense of the liberation of Palestine are our Jewish comrades, like, you know, like deeply active, like fighting for the liberation of Palestine. So it's not just like, it's not even about like religion, really. It's just about settler colonial Zionism, which is using religion as a mask for what it's doing, you know?
Okay. So as someone who is just now like diving as much as I can into all of it and trying to find out as much as I can, do you have any good resources that, and I'm asking a lot of you, and if you don't have an answer, I completely understand. And I can do my own research very easily, you know, and I do, but I'm always looking for really good resources to learn more about this very, very long conflict.
I think one of the best ones I could recommend is actually not even one I've personally read, but I've like been around it a lot, which is The 100 Years of War on Palestine by Rashid Khalidi.
Okay.
Is great and like goes through sort of like a more recent retelling of history for people that are like really academic that might want to know, like that are like grappling with questions of like, well, it was this like the ancestral Jewish land and what does that mean? And so were Palestinians there or not? And like, are the Palestinians actually the colonizers? And is if Jewish people are they returning?
Right.
Are the Jewish people from Europe returning home? And is it actually like the land belonged to them and things like that? Palestine, 4,000 year history is great if for people battling with or like grappling with those questions. But that one's like very academic, a little bit like headier. But the 100 year history is like a lot more palatable. There's also a really great historian, Ilan Pape, who writes like more accessible stuff. He's not Palestinian and I believe was banished because he's
he speaks for the Palestinian side of things.
Yeah, he's like a archaeologist and historian who is Israeli. So he's had access to like artifacts and has studied artifacts in Palestine, and but then his findings continue to lead him to like, oh, this is a problematic, terrible settler colonial project. He's very much like in support of Palestinian people and of free Palestine. So some people appreciate reading from his perspective since he grew up Israeli, you know.
100%. Yes. Those sound like great. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm sure the listeners are thanking you too. That's great to know. And they are probably way more well-versed than I am at this point. Most people are in everything. So, but good to have the stuff.
Do you mind if I say one more thing about the Palestine thing and just people who are learning more. I also just want to like destigmatize and like de-shame folks who have been like in both sides thinking their whole life, or even like in more Zionist thinking without knowing it. Because especially people living in America or like settler colonial US project, like whatever that, wherever, that is like, that is the narrative we are given and pushed. So it's like really no fault of people to just be, have been in that, and it's okay. And now, you know, just keep going with pursue, you know, what is the truth underneath the story that the powers that be have been trying to tell me for a long time.
Right. Well, there's a lot of information to dive into.
Yeah.
Right. And in my case, it's just been like, I'm not anywhere near it. I don't need to know about it. And which is not great at all. And yeah. Now my eyes are open. And now I personally want to do my part to really, really, really understand everything about it all. That's on our soil now too. I mean, yeah. It always has been, actually. Yes. Didn't realize that. Right. It you has, know what I mean? Yes. So yeah. So there's a lot to learn.
That's great. Proud of you. And it's rewarding. The Palestinian people are beautiful people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
as are all people.
Absolutely.
Like, hello.
Turns out people are wonderful. All of them.
Uh-huh.
Humans and also can be shitty too.
Truth.
And we all deserve the right to be, you know, the full spectrum of human.
Can you please tell everyone how they can get a hold of you and where to get your offerings and what, you know, all the things?
So for folks that might be interested in doing the queer trans birth class, like, first of all, I have like really abundant sliding scale options. It's like meant to be very accessible to folks. And then if my sliding scale options are still not enough, it's like all over my website. Email me, tell me. That's embodiedbirthclass.com. And I also have like, I have an Instagram. I have like a lot of content and videos that I've thrown up on there, embodied.birth. And sometimes I'll have like webinars and such coming up, sometimes free or just like sliding scale, donation based, whatever. Like, I'm doing one called Defeminizing Birth next Tuesday, and it's just like $0 to $65. So pay what you want.
Oh.
So there's little things like that you can find there. And then, yeah, sometimes I'm speaking at various places and things. I'll usually throw that on my website, but I would say the Instagram and my email list on my website are like good places to keep up.
Okay. And that will all be listed in the notes, the show notes, so everybody can find you there. This has been a wonderful conversation. I'm so happy to know you, and I feel honored to have been able to speak to you. So thank you so much.
Yeah, that was so lovely.
Queer Family Podcast.
A special thank you once again to California Cryobank for being a sponsor of this episode. Use code QueerFam25 for a free level 2 subscription to their donor catalog. And tune in next week for another amazing episode of Queer Family Goodness.
Love is love.
Whew. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I enjoyed it. And if you did enjoy it, feel free to listen to another or watch another. I have so many episodes for your listening or viewing pleasure. Just go pick one and enjoy. There's a lot. There really is. And also, if you really do like this show, please, I know I say it all the time, but please do consider supporting the show on Patreon. You're just going to go to patreon.com/thequeerfamilypodcast. You're going to pick a tier, you're going to join, and you're going to get that bonus content. And you're also going to get my love and adoration for the rest of my life. I love you all. Thanks for tuning in. Keep on tuning in. And I'll see you next time. Mwah.